This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This past weekend, NASA's rover Opportunity landed safely on the rusty red surface of Mars. It's the second computer-controlled explorer this month to beam back pictures of alien landscapes. NASA reports more than 2.5 billion hits on its website over the past few weeks, and there is reasonable cause for all that excitement. Getting even a robot to Mars isn't easy, after all. 2 out of 3 missions to Mars fail, and even amid this recent success, NASA's other Mars rover, Spirit, is battling a computer crash. But there are also unreasonable causes for excitement. This is Mars, for heaven's sakes, the planet that's inspired centuries of speculation about lost civilizations and space travel. Listen to this excerpt, written by Ray Bradbury, from the 1955 radio drama X-0.
Someday, a giant metal ship will take off from Earth to travel through the black velocities, the silent gulfs of space, to descend at last into the darkness of the upper Martian atmospheres. And on that day, man will finally know the answers. The day we first land on Mars.
Later in this program, we'll return to troubles here on Earth and talk with John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker magazine about politics in Iraq and one man who's emerged as a leading candidate for president there. But first, the real and imaginative history of Mars. Are you intrigued by science or science fiction? Whether you're looking at the new pictures from Mars or older ones from Hollywood, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now to talk about the history of Mars is Dr. Bill Sheehan, who's the co-author of Mars, The Lure of the Red Planet. He's with us by phone from Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil.
And what are you doing up at the observatory?
Well, I'm sitting about 50 yards from the largest spyglass-type telescope in the world, the 40-inch Yerkes Refractor, and wishing Mars were a little closer so I could point it towards Mars tonight. But, of course, it's much too far away, and best viewing these days is on the web sites that you cited.
Well, Mars, of course, is visible with the naked eye and visibly different with the naked eye, that color, of course. Is there a first recorded instance of when mankind first noticed Mars?
One of the things people sometimes wonder about is whether Mars can even be seen without a telescope. And, of course, it becomes very bright at times. Last August, it was so bright that it really dominated the heavens. It was brighter than any other planet or star that was visible at the time. And last August, it was closer to the Earth than it had been in 60,000 years. So the last time that we had this good of a view was when the Neanderthals were still in Europe and Homo sapiens hadn't arrived there. But Mars has always allured people, partly because of its changes in brightness. It goes from being an extremely brilliant, majestic, star-like object to being very dim, almost like a fading ember in the sky as it is now. And the other is the red color, which makes it stand out from the other stars and planets. And I think the color red is the one that has the most effect on our emotions, certainly like the eyes of the poisonous tree frogs in the Amazon. It's both something that allures and also has a sign of danger. So even in the ancient times, the Babylonians, for instance, observed it. They called it the Star of Death, and the Greeks and Romans named it after the god of war. So Mars has always been recorded with fascination by people that have looked into the sky.
Mars, of course, the name of the god of war in Roman mythology, and Ares, of course, I guess is what the Greeks would have called it. The first person to look through one of those spyglasses, I guess, was Galileo Galilei, and he saw some remarkable things.
Well, Galileo saw a lot of interesting things. He discovered the craters and mountains of the moon. He discovered the satellites of Jupiter, sunspots. But he didn't see very much on Mars. The telescope that he had was only a bit more powerful than field glasses of today. And one has to keep in mind that Mars is never closer, even when it's at a very favorable presentation, as it was last summer, than 140 times farther away from us than the moon. And the other thing is Mars is a small planet. It's only about half the size of the Earth. So in Galileo's telescope, all he was really able to see was kind of a tiny ochre disk without any detail. He did look for the phase of Mars, since Mars is outside of the Earth's orbit.
Mm-hmm.
The Copernican theory predicted that it would show a gibbous phase, a little bit like what the moon shows about 3 days from full. It wouldn't show a half phase or a crescent phase like Venus does. And Galileo suspected that he saw that, but his telescope just wasn't really very good to show much on Mars. And so it really waited for about 50 years before astronomers had good enough telescopes to start showing sharp detail on Mars.
And is that when the speculation began?
It did. The first person to actually see anything on Mars, other than just sort of the phase, was a Dutch astronomer named Christian Huygens in 1659. He had a better telescope than Galileo's, and what he saw was a wedge-shaped marking that for a long time was known as the hourglass sea. And the reason for the name was partly the shape. It was a bit like an hourglass, but also once you start seeing surface features on a planet, you can determine its rotation period, the length of its day and night. And Huygens determined that Mars had a day just a little bit longer than the Earth. He also discovered polar caps, which seemed to change with the seasons. And so Mars, early on as that, was earmarked as a planet that was somewhat Earth-like, a planet that had a similar day to ours, similar season. So it really was already at that time possible to say, let me see what spring is like on Mars.
Jupiter and Mars.
Yeah, exactly. So that was really when it started. And Mars, even at that point, started to emerge as the leading contender for a world of life, including intelligent life. The moon, obviously, is a world without any air. It's kind of a wasteland of what were then believed to be barren cinder cones of volcanoes. Venus, though, in some ways an alluring planet, was shrouded with perpetual clouds, so we could never get a glimpse of the surface. Giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, even though they're majestic globes, were covered with clouds and gas world. So really Mars was the one planet that seemed to offer us something similar to what we were familiar with on the Earth.
We're speaking with William Sheehan about the allure of Mars. In a little bit, we're going to start talking about the imagined history of Mars. If you have a favorite film or novel about life on Mars, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. But if you have real questions about the real Mars, of course, we have Dr. Sheehan with us as well. As we move along in the history of Mars, though, Bill Sheehan, really it was Percival Lowell, one of the more accidental offense astronomers of all time.
Yeah, this takes us, Neil, into the 19th century. By then, people were able to start making maps of Mars and showed in distorted form some of the surface features that looked, at least in general terms, like the continents and seas of the Earth. The poet Tennyson wrote not too long before Percival Lowell, kind of, if we could see Mars more closely, would there be wars and carnage and things of that sort? And he also talked about the snows of moonless Mars, which was a line of poetry that led to an astronomical discovery. In 1877, Asaph Hall used the big refracting telescope at the U.S. Naval Observatory, which was then at Foggy Bottom, not a very promising site for an observing station, but to discover the two moons of Mars. And that same year, an Italian astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was observing in Milan, decided that it was time for a new map of Mars. So he accurately depicted the surface markings and created a nomenclature, a system of naming the features of Mars, which was tied in with the geography of the classical world, the Bible, Greek literature. And he was the one that really invested Mars, if you will, in an aura of myth and imagination by giving all of these romantic names to the planet. The Lake of the Sun, Utopia, Eden, and the Land of Gold. So he sort of set the stage for Lowell's speculations. He also observed some markings that were on the verge of his telescopic vision. And to him, they appeared to be linear features. He, in fact, called them canali, which is Italian for grooves. But as soon as the word was translated to English, it was translated as canals. And this was in 1877, a time when some of the great engineering feats of the Earth included the Suez Canal, which had just opened. So the idea of canal builders on Mars really was sort of the acme of what people believe civilized people to be capable of. And Percival Lowell was one of these colorful people. He was born into a very prominent Boston family. James Russell Lowell, the poet, was a cousin of his. His brother, Abbott Lawrence Lowell, was president of Harvard for years. He had a younger sister who was Amy Lowell, a cigar-smoking poet. And Lowell, after graduating from Harvard, spent a while managing family business trusts, made enough money to be able to do pretty much what he pleased, and set off for 10 years of travel in the Far East, wrote several books about Korea and Japan. And then when he kind of got tired of that, finding out about Schiaparelli's discoveries having to do with Mars, in 1893 he decided to abandon the Far East for the far out and went out to Arizona with a couple borrowed telescopes and started observing Mars with the intensity of obsession. And that was really when Mars ended up on the map of most of the general public.
And when we started to populate it with little green men.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lowell, of course, was using a telescope that was very similar to the one that we have here at Yerkes. And this was a romantic period of planetary astronomy when people did with telescopes what any member of the public that has access to one wants to do, that is look through it. And Lowell sat at his observing chair and would wait for these glimpses of fine detail on Mars, and then he would try to represent those in sketches. And before long, his sketches were filled with canals, and he had evolved a wonderful theory about how Mars had evolved. His idea was that since Mars is smaller than the Earth, it had evolved more quickly through its career as a planet. It had become largely desert. There were deserts on the Earth, of course, like the Sahara Desert, but that process had proceeded faster on Mars. And so the planet was really in an advanced state of desiccation, and presuming that life developed on Mars, it would also be more advanced than the Earth. And the only way to stave off doom would be to build these canals to pump water from the polar caps into the desert areas. And that was essentially Lowell's theory, which he promulgated in a book in 1895 called Mars. It was really a bestseller and made Lowell somewhat of the equivalent of the 19th century's Carl Sagan. He electrified the public. And after that, Mars mania, Mars furor, hysteria about Mars was commonplace.
Let's get a caller involved, 800-989-8255. And Suleiman joins us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay, hello. I was wondering what is so special about Mars instead of any other planet like Mercury or Venus?
Yeah, why do we think life is on Mars?
Besides the fact that of the dried riverbeds on there?
Well, the other planets certainly have interesting facets. Mercury is very close to the sun. It's a parched desert world that was once described by Percival Lowell as the bleached bones of a world. It really looks extremely inhospitable.
And you may have to move along.
Yeah.
Just to pick it up, we just have a few seconds left.
Okay.
And so the other planets...
Venus is basically a hell escape. I mean, the temperature on Venus, because of a runaway greenhouse effect, is so great that it would, you know, lead would run on the surface, and you know, the giant planets are frozen gas balls. So Mars is really the only place that looks promising for life.
Dr. Sheehan is, of course, talking about the real reasons about life on other planets. Of course, Jovian sounds pretty funny, and so does Venusians. Martian sounds pretty good. Suleiman, thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Photos from the surface of Mars are making headlines, but today on Talk of the Nation, we're stepping back from the scientific discoveries to look at Mars as a cultural force. We want to hear from you. What's your reaction to the images coming back from Mars? Do they match the science fiction images that have made impressions in your mind? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Bill Sheehan, the co-author of Mars, The Lure of the Red Planet. And joining us now from his office in Seattle is David Catling, a professor of astrobiology at the Seattle campus of the University of Washington. He's also spent some time working at the NASA Ames Research Center. And when he's not studying science of Mars, he's examining the portrayal of Mars in popular culture. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
As we heard earlier from Bill, the word of canals, improperly translated as it may have been, canals seem to spark the imagination of writers. When's the first time we see Mars in a fictional setting?
Well,
I think around the late 19th century, Mars begins to take hold of the popular imagination. And, of course, Percival Lowell was a brilliant public lecturer. He published magazine articles, and he had tireless efforts at popularization. And really, this led up or set the stage for H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, which I think is probably the most significant novel. Essentially, H.G. Wells was out with his brother one day walking in Surrey in England, and his brother was saying, you know, what would extraterrestrials do? How would they communicate with us, supposing they arrived on the Earth? And H.G. Wells took a rather pessimistic view. He said, well, I think they would treat us like the Europeans have treated the Tasmanians. The Tasmanian Aborigines were basically wiped out in a rather brutal way by European settlers. And this actually was the basis for H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds.
Hmm. Let's get another listener involved, and this is Lee, and Lee is with us from Minneapolis.
Hi there, Neil. Thanks
Hi there.
For having me on.
Hi.
Love your show. It's
Thank
just
you.
Fabulous. Do it every day.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I wanted to comment on my favorite Martian movie, and it's Mars Attack.
Where the War of the Worlds principle is inverted. The Martians invade Earth.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And what I wanted to say was that in our culture, it always seems that we think that wherever we go, people should do what we want them to do. But in this movie, the Martians take over our lands, and
well,
pretty much want to wipe everybody out.
And let's hear a clip from the movie. This is Sarah Jessica Parker's character, Natalie Lake, quizzing her professor, played by Pierce Brosnan, about life on the Red Planet.
Professor, isn't it weird that we sent a space probe to Mars and we didn't even find anyone?
Well, not really, Natalie, because we didn't get into the canals. The Martian canals are actually canyons, some of them over 100 miles deep. Martian civilization has clearly developed under the surface of the planet. Their science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Not to mention their recording effects. Anyway, Lee, the Martians, of course, were missed by all of those probes and took over the White House.
That's exactly right, and we almost lost our president, Jack Nicholson, because of it.
David Catlin, as you go on through thanks for the call, Lee. As you go on through the history of Mars in popular culture, certainly the War of the Worlds set the trend.
Yes, and basically most of the novels and the movies that we see have recapitulated the ideas of the wars of the world in some way or another. I mean, Mars Attacks is an example of that, but the other thing is that really starting in the late 19th century, Mars in popular culture began to get slightly strange. In the late 19th century, we had psychics who were getting in contact with the planet Mars, and some were even speaking Martian. We had people, radio engineers, famous radio engineers, who thought they were picking up signals from Mars, Marconi and Tesla, for example. And this fed a sort of frenzy of interest in Mars in the early part of the 1900s, but it sort of died away beginning about the 1920s, when gradually astronomers began to know more information about Mars, and it looked like it had a thin atmosphere, it was very dry, the temperature was cold, and so there was a lull, and then we get the 1950s and 1960s, and then there's anything but a lull at that point.
Bill Sheehan, as science learned more about the actual conditions on the surface of Mars, writers proceeded to put Martians underground or find some other reason for their apparent inability to live on the surface.
That's right. And actually, one of the interesting things about science fiction is that it really has lagged behind in some respects. The first novel that didn't include canals was Arthur C. Clarke's The Sands of Mars in 1950. More recently, people like Kim Stanley Robinson have written books that are very well-versed in the geology of Mars. And as you mentioned, you know, they've become much more creative in where they deploy their Martians, since obviously the canals have, to some extent, gone the way of cobwebs.
As we move ahead, David Catling, as you mentioned, the 1950s, Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, a great piece of science fiction writing, portrays Mars, civilization rather similar to Earth's. In the story, the first visit to the planet results in the annihilation of the entire planet. Here's a clip. Two interstellar travelers, Donald Buca and Roger Dukovin, discuss the potential dangers of humans inhabiting a new planet.
I'm seeing what we'll do to Mars. We'll rip it up, rip the skin off, ruin it the way we've ruined our own planet. Captain, look at the city. It may be the last time you'll ever see it this way.
Beautiful in the moonlight, isn't it?
Yes. There's a poem by Byron that describes it, and how the Martians would feel tonight if there were any of them left. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night. Though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast. And the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself must rest. Though the night was made for loving and the day returns too soon. Yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
That from a radio adaptation of the Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury and David Catlin. As you listen to that, clearly the nostalgia for civilizations long dead.
Yeah, the Martian Chronicles is really the reverse of the War of the Worlds. So in the War of the Worlds, we have these aliens that come and invade the Earth, and eventually, the aliens die off because of terrestrial germs. But in the Martian Chronicles, it's the other way around. The humans are going to Mars, and they're destroying what's an ancient and wise civilization. So really, the book actually raises some interesting questions about human behavior and about how people should react when they encounter alien races. And so it goes back, really, to the War of the Worlds concept, which originated in H.G. Wells' concern about how Europeans were treating indigenous people. It all basically goes back to that.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Tom is with us from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
One interesting fictional work on Mars is Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Oh, John Carter, of course.
Yes, John Carter of Mars. It was a kind of a, it's a very different from what you're talking about, those other stories, which are very wonderful. But John Carter goes there and is sort of thrust into this Martian society, which is very competitive. All the races are competing against each other as the resources of this planet die out. It's kind of I believe he portrays it as a planet that's drying up.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the scientific facts about Mars were becoming known, and Burroughs, you know, included that in this very detailed sort of study of what Martian civilization might be like.
Yeah, and but John Carter buckled a pretty mean swash. I mean, it was
absolutely—it
was all an adventure romp.
Absolutely, but there were some scientific facts about Mars lurking around in there. That
well, Bill Sheehan, what do you say?
Yeah, actually, the dichotomy that you're talking about really started with Lowell, because at the same time that Lowell was talking about Mars as being more advanced and evolved than the Earth and dying, which meant sort of this nostalgia, which was also somewhat of a late 19th century nostalgia for the past and kind of the ambivalence at which Lowell and others were looking at the future. There was also this sense of the Martians as being technologically sophisticated, whether they would put that to application by building canals or whether they would put that into practice by invading the Earth and doing things like we did to the Tasmanians as Europeans. So there was certainly that kind of attention, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, his landscapes of Mars were very much inspired by Lowell. He talks about the canals, and it's very much a sort of a Darwinian struggle for survival with all of this almost surrealistic population of these tharks and the various characters that he creates. So there certainly was that sort of a sense of whether, as civilization became more advanced, it would become malignant, or whether it would somehow rise above it.
Mm-hmm.
And Lowell himself actually thought that in order to create this canal system, the Martians would have to have put party politics aside, given up petty differences, and allowed themselves to be ruled by the wisest people like Lowell himself and the Boston Brahmins that he was descended from. But there certainly was this tension, and Burroughs, of course, used a Martian landscape to project his very, in some ways, dreamlike and nightmarish characterizations.
Mm-hmm. Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Sure. Let's go now to Debbie, and Debbie's with us from Sonoma, California.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering if anybody's read the book. It's called That Hideous Strength. It's part of a trilogy by C.S. Lewis about Mars and Venus and Earth. And he has a great story about Mars, that the canals are really very deep and there's rivers and greenery at the bottom, and he has a set of creatures that live there. And then there's another whole set of creatures that live up at the top that are very, very long and tall and elongated because of the lack of gravity. And it's just a very interesting story. He's kind of put some spiritualism in it because that's the kind of writer he was.
C.S. Lewis. Remind me, I know Perelandra and That Hideous Strength. What's the third one?
The Silent Planet.
Uh-huh.
And I think The Silent Planet's about Earth.
David Catlin?
Well, again, we see the influence of Lowell's world view on things. We've got the canals in the story. Vegetation was a very popular idea in the 19th century because Lowell's ideas boil down to two things. One is that the polar caps on Mars were made of water ice, and that's partly true, they are, but in fact we now know they're covered with carbon dioxide ice on top of that. And his other main argument, of course, was the canals, and this was partly connected also to seeing some seasonal changes on the surface of Mars, which was attributed to changes in vegetation. So it's a very popular idea that canals were spreading water around the planet. The planet was drying up, the atmosphere was vanishing, and people lived in this kind of environment on Mars. And it really wasn't until the 1920s that scientists had really quite serious doubts, but even then, that didn't the public perception of Mars.
Debbie, thanks for the reminder of C.F. Lewis.
Yeah, it was a great book.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye.
And thanks to our guests as well, David Catling, a professor of astrobiology at the University of Washington and Seattle. We spoke with him from his office in Seattle. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to Dr. William Sheehan, co-author of Mars, The Lure of the Red Planet. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As we've mentioned, the silver screen has had its share of Martian invasions, from 1953's Invaders from Mars to the more recent Mission to Mars. Seattle Times reporter Mark Rahner says all of these films have two things in common. One, they involve a certain red planet, and two, they all stink. He joins us now from his office in Seattle, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hi, Neil. How are you? Nice to be here.
Are all the Mars movies really that bad?
Well, they don't all just completely reek, but it does seem like over the years, Mars has become the focal point of some awfully cheesy stuff.
Well, what's your favorite cheesy movie?
My favorite is one I actually had to leave off a list that we had in the paper here called Robinson Crusoe on Mars, back from 1964. You got an astronaut traveling this vast distance to the red planet, and he finds a manservant there. I think that's why George Bush wants to spend such a phenomenal amount of money to go to Mars. He thinks there's servants there.
I have to say, I've always been very fond of Angry Red Planet.
That's a good one, too. You'd be angry, too, if... tinted you pink. You know, special effects back in 1960 when that one came out weren't what they are today, so to depict the environment, what the environment would be like on this distant, hostile, strange world, they just kind of tinted the film sort of a pinkish red. It's fabulous. I think that's the film they'll be showing on Rosie O'Donnell's Gay Cruise.
Let's get a caller in, and Levi joins us from Boise, Idaho.
Hi.
Hi.
I think your caller is right, though, about Bush, but I think the real reason he's going is because Governor Schwarzenegger told him to get his ass to Mars in Total Recall.
That's
my favorite movie about Mars.
That makes perfect sense to me. Yeah, Total Recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger beating
Total
people
classic.
Up, wrecking stuff on Mars. And
right.
I love it when his eyes bulge out because
yes.
It looks like he's about to grope a production.
Howard Dean must have seen that picture.
Probably.
Absolutely. Yeah, the shriek was familiar, wasn't it?
Levi, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Let's get somebody else on the line. This is James, and James is with us from Medina, Ohio.
Yes, thank you. Wonderful show.
Thank you.
I just have to mention something to your critic. I got a telescope when I was 12 years old over 50 years ago, and I couldn't wait till it got dark. But that's another story. The movie I'd like to suggest was really not so bad, and this goes back 54 years ago. This is Rocket Ship XM, 1950. It's black and white. I've only seen it once when I was a kid. And they take off for the moon, and there's a mistake. And, well, we're just going to have to go to Mars, land on Mars, and they find it. Then the camera then switches to sepia, and they find ancient ruins, and then they find these ape-like creatures with awful teeth throwing boulders at them, and they wear, I think, standard oxygen masks that you would see in a standard 1950-type war movie. And they realize that was a mistake, and they leave. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, Lloyd Bridges may have been in that. As I say, I haven't seen it since 1950, but that's it. Rocket Ship XM, of course, experimental, to the moon, and then, something went wrong.
Or, as the president told us, the moon and beyond.
We had to go to Mars.
Well, you raise a good point about the ape-like creatures, because there's a monkey in Robinson Crusoe on Mars. And let me just say, if there is life on Mars, I sure hope there's some monkeys.
James, thanks very much for the call.
All right.
And Mark Rahner, we appreciate your time today as well.
Nice to be here.
Mark Rahner is a popular culture writer for the Seattle Times, and he spoke to us by phone from his office there in Seattle.